Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Let's get into it because we did hear from Jay Powell and we've got a great twosome to talk about it. Bloomberg News international economics and policy correspondent and deadhead Michael McKee. He's got his ticket on his phone. I saw him walk in. He's here in
studio. I walked in listening to last year's concert.
Did you really? Is that what you were doing?
Yeah, the opening song. Do you remember that?
I didn't go to last year's concert. It was a mistake, and I heard it was amazing.
What was the opening song?
The opening song was playing in the band.
I just hope there's no welcoming in the rain tonight or tomorrow.
Okay.
Tomorrow is a problem.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Let's focus. Focus, kids. All right, let's get Bloomberg News Economics Editor Molly Smith. She's also here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. So, Mike, let's start with you. I did take a kind of peek into TV, and we basically got the same thing from JP.
Yeah. Well, his opening statement was exactly the same, almost word for word. They just moved a few paragraphs around, but they didn't change any of the language.
Just to keep it interesting.
As we got from his opening statement last Wednesday. So I think he walked in there going, I'm not going to make news. Mm-hmm. And he generally succeeded, other than perhaps on The Grateful Dead or Dead and Company. But
that was pretty funny.
But he did. I talked to some people at the Fed who were very disappointed that I and Steve Leisman from CNBC, the two big deadheads of the Fed press corps, did not ask him at the press conference.
I can't believe you guys didn't either. Leisman plays in like a Dead cover band,
doesn't he? And he's
were
a friend of Bob
Weir's. Were people
afraid
to do it or what?
It just didn't seem like the right atmosphere at the time when I got called on. I mean, Matt and I had worked on questions that would incorporate the lyrics, but we didn't get a chance to do it.
That's when you got to kind of know the room, and if he's not in the mood for it, right? Like, you just
right.
kind of pass on it.
Yeah.
Okay, so nothing new. Molly, come on in on this. Are you a deadhead? Have you ever been to a Dead concert?
I have not. And
we can remedy that.
We yeah. could. Yeah.
Still got I guess room in the bus tonight.
I'll clear my schedule.
I'm going to tell you, it would be quite an experience knowing who's going. Okay, so what did you take away from Jay Powell?
Yeah, pretty boring today, honestly, which I think is, yeah, to Mike's point, mission accomplished on that. He really did get grilled a lot on both sides about the Fed's response to the banking failures in March. And I was kind of surprised thinking, you know, we just had last week's Fed meeting, and that was like a couple, you know, the big surprise saying like there are another two rate hikes possibly to come this year. And that should be top of mind for most lawmakers, and that inflation is still, you know, pretty rampant and affecting their constituents pretty seriously right now. But they really just went hard on the banking stuff. And I think Jay didn't really give us a whole lot to work with on that, would often defer to Vice Chair of Supervision Michael Barr, who prepared a report right. in the aftermath of SPV's collapse, and also deflected some other questions to the FDIC, which has handled some of these banks that have since failed.
The bank failures actually was pointed out to me in a note today by Véronique de Rougy. Do you know, she's an economist at Mercatus. And, you know, from her perspective, the fact that the Fed isn't, and again, this is from her perspective, the fact that the Fed hasn't been straight with the American people about this, the condition of the U.S. banking system is part of the reason that they don't have credibility with the markets.
How has he not been straight with them?
Because they say the banks, banking system in this country is sound and resilient. And she points out that there are some examples that clearly show it's not sound and resilient.
Yeah, but if those are, to be fair, would you say those are more the exception than the rule?
Well, you asking me or Veronique? Because
I'm asking you. You're an intelligent guy, Matt. You're a servant.
Yeah, of course, because we've only seen a couple of bank failures, and there are, what, 6,000 banks in America?
Yeah, no, there's no systemic risk, really, from any of them, it doesn't seem.
Yeah,
and as Jay Powell pointed out, there's some bad bank managers out there.
Yeah, you know, he kept saying, overwhelmingly, banks have handled interest rate risk well. There are a few of them that did not.
But what I'm trying to get at is, why does the Fed have such little credibility? We had guests on, chief economists from the biggest banks on surveillance last week. One after the other said they don't believe the Fed's going to continue to raise rates. They think it's over.
Oh, history. That's just learned behavior. The Fed has always stepped in when markets get bad. And you have a whole generation of traders who grew up with no idea of what it's like to have the Fed on the sideline. And you talk to the people in the old bond vigilante days, who were many years before Carol and I, knew. But the modern day folks, the Fed's been in the markets for 20 years now.
Mike, you look at the warp function. I mean, traders are still betting on a cut this year.
Warp. No, we should explain to the listeners, right? WIRP is the world function on the Bloomberg terminal that shows
WIRP
expects.
And they're not betting on a cut anymore this year. As a matter of fact, they still have rates.
In December, a little
nope,
bit?
Nope, not in December.
I think most of those were pretty fully priced out as of last week, right?
Here's the confusion, and this is into this a lot because people don't understand how WIRP works.
Because I feel I agree with Carol. It looks to me like there's going to be one hike.
Look, Carol,
and then one cut.
Implied rate.
Yeah.
It goes up to a high in November of 5.32%.
Got a hike to get
and
there.
Then it gets and then it gets cut down back to where we are now.
Okay.
So in essence, it's not cutting rates from where we are now.
Okay, but
it presumes that you get up there. Also,
I get you, Carol. I
get you too.
I'm looking at WIRP and I see there's one hike and one cut.
Gee, all right, get this boy out of here, Mike. Matt, you're out of here. Not Matt, Mike. Okay, but the point is, and Romain made the point too in our simulcast that. Markets, look at where yields have kind of eased from the movement up higher earlier.
Yeah.
So it does feel like within the trade, investors see something different versus what the Fed says.
Well, the interesting thing is, and I've asked a lot of strategists
about this. I used to like you,
this.
Mike. I'm just going to put it out there.
Always loved you, sweetie.
Okay.
I've asked a lot of strategists about this, and basically what you have is the general belief among strategists at all the major banks and everywhere else is that the Fed is not going to cut rates.
Okay.
They're basing their buying strategy in the markets on the idea the Fed is not going to cut rates. But if inflation comes down fast, either because the Fed does a super job or because we have a recession, then the Fed would be cutting rates. And that is a possibility. So you put some money in options on that possibility. You take out an option on a Fed rate cut in December.
So you kind of cover all your bets.
Yeah, I mean, Ira Jersey's really good on this. If you have him on, he's really good at how this is not really real. Also, the Fed funds market.
He's not going to mansplain warp to me?
That's dangerous.
I kid.
Ooh.
I so respect Mike, and you know I would have him on every day.
By the way, Rafael Basta came out and said what the Fed is doing right now is essentially passive tightening. That's the phrase he used, right?
So I like that.
To your point, right, if inflation comes down and they don't cut rates, if they just leave them where they are, that's passive tightening. And I wonder if some members of the Fed think that's what they should be doing right now.
Well, Jay did today then again say that not only is this not a skip, which he said last week, but then today he said it's not a pause. So I don't really know what the terminology is, but either way, they did not hike rates last week. And the idea right now is we're going to see all the data, how it comes in, and make our next move based off of that. So yeah, I like that passively tightening phrase as well. And that does seem to be what they have been communicating to us.
Do you feel like Jay Powell, Mike, has been pretty clear? I mean, I feel like they're data dependent. I believe that.
Yeah, I mean, they've been clear to a point. I mean, they're no longer trying to give straight guidance. We're going to do X on such and such a date. They don't want the markets to price in cuts, so they put in the high dot plot and they talk about the fact that we're going to raise rates more, but they're not putting a date on it. They're not putting conditions on it. They're not saying what
possible.
They need to see. Yeah, anything's possible, which is a very unusual condition for people on Wall Street, let alone, you know, whatever age they are, however long they've been around.
Might he just get this right?
Oh, sure. There's a chance they can get it right, and everybody will be gobsmacked by that and say, that's never happened before, which is why they don't think they'll accomplish it, because it's never happened before.
Someday they'll write books about Jim
1994,
Powell.
They sort of did, but they didn't have...
That was the only other soft landing?
Well, they didn't have a big inflation. They were trying to get out in front of inflation, and they did, and they raised rates, and they destroyed the bond market, but they did not destroy the economy.
So passive tightening, is that what we're calling it? What was it?
That's what Raphael Bostic
like
said. Passive tightening.
Passive tightening?
I mean, they don't actually raise rates, but the real rate goes higher as inflation comes down.
Yeah. And Jay also did say today, too, that like, he doesn't really know where the terminal rate is going to be, like what that rate is that accomplishes getting maximum employment plus price stability. So who the heck knows? We could have two more hikes. We could have two cuts. We could have nothing. Yeah. So.
By the way, we should have more hikes from the BOE and the ECB
because
their real rates are still well underwater.
Tune in tomorrow as our friends at the Bank of England have their meeting. Yeah.
They are having a tough fight there when it comes to inflation. All right. Love you both. Michael McKee, international economics and policy correspondent at Bloomberg News, off to a dead concert. Molly Smith, economics editor at Bloomberg News, not off to a dead concert. Matt is too. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Do you love the Daryl Hall with the with the long hair?
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
For sure.
But then he got a cut.
It was a little bit of a mullet. Right. I like that.
Yeah. I don't like mullets. All right. So Matt, we talked yesterday about a story that concerns have been highlighted when it comes to the private credit world. Pressures of higher interest rates, what it means for those borrowers, floating rates, as you said. Oh my God.
Safe to say that you and I are both pretty well obsessed with private credit and
I am. Yeah. Anywhere where I feel like I don't have a total handle on it and everybody's like, don't worry, it's going to be okay. So let's get into the private world, which includes, of course, private equity. With us is Kate Ambrose, CEO of the Global Private Capital Association. It's a nonprofit, independent membership organization representing private capital investors who manage some $2 trillion in assets globally. We're talking about a KKR. We're talking about Bill and Melinda Gates, CalSTRS. We're talking about the former Silicon Valley Bank, academic institutions, and more. So looking forward to our conversation. She's here in our Bloomberg Interactive
Broker
Studio.
Is this essentially a lobbying group or
what?
When I see nonprofit together with private equity, like alarm bells go off. Why does private equity need a nonprofit?
Right. Love that question. Love it. We are a very unique organization. The organization was founded as the Emerging Markets Private Equity Association by the IFC of the World Bank over 20 years ago.
Oh my God.
So it was founded by the first LPs in funds in emerging markets. And grew to some prominence at the period of time that there was this idea that emerging markets was going to be an asset class in and of itself that was going to be faster younger demographics, faster growth, that would be a rising tide that would lift all boats, and grew to some significant size. I joined in 2019 as CEO and really to reposition the organization for the future to reflect what's going on in the world today. The terminology emerging markets is 40 years out of date. It's 40 years old. It's just completely outdated. China's the world's second largest economy. So many of the opportunities and so much capital flows from these places in the world. So we are now the Global Private Capital Association. The regions that we cover are Asia, Latin America, Africa, Central and Eastern Europe, and the Middle East. But our board includes, for example, Bill Ford of General Atlantic, one of the world's largest private equity firms, as you mentioned, KKR. Others are members. We have, for example, Temasek, the Singapore sovereign fund, their chief investment officer.
That's fascinating.
Our board of directors.
So essentially, it was the organization was started to kind of shepherd growth through private equity in these markets.
Exactly. And the reposition.
So nonprofit, is that wrong?
We are the same structure as a National Venture Capital Association in the U.S. or a private equity council, which indeed are lobby groups. The beauty, and this is why we use the word independent, is that because we cover all of these markets, we're not there to lobby on behalf of lower tax, you know, rates for or preferential regulatory treatment for our members. We're really there to evangelize capital and educate on the opportunities across global markets. And the last thing I'll say is we are not a U.S. lobby group. We are truly a global organization. Again, our board includes the leading fund managers from India, Africa, Latin America, both global firms and local firms.
So where does your funding come from?
Membership dues. So over 300 member firms pay dues to be members of the organization. We have a very dynamic research platform. I can throw some data off the top of my head in terms of fundraising and trends and things like private equity.
What I'm getting is that the World Bank said, we need to shepherd growth through this mechanism, private equity, and a good way to do that is put together an organization to support it.
So the IFC is the International Finance Corporation. And they were limited partners in funds. So they actually put money into funds.
I see.
And there's a whole universe of development finance institutions, including the U.S. DFC, which is what the U.S. uses to compete with China, frankly, around the world, putting money into funds. So it really, it's more commercial than sort of what we're describing, but we are a nonprofit organization.
USDFC, the Development Finance Corporation.
Yes.
Okay, so if you had to say your top priority in your organization, number one, just one, what is it?
Wow, that's tough. There's kind of twins, so I may cheat.
Okay.
One is to just re-educate the world on the opportunities and the realities and the risks of investing in these markets. And the second would be to influence capital towards greater long-term inclusive growth and environmental
sustainability.
Private
capital.
Yes, private capital.
I am obsessed. Matt, we're both obsessed. And I feel like I keep saying this last couple of times I've been at Milken and we've done broadcasts. Doesn't seem like anybody cares about the public markets. It's all about the private markets, private credit, private equity.
Well, those people, you're hanging around the wrong people if you want to talk public markets.
But there's also, But so, but I mean, tell us about, from your perspective, because I think there's some nervousness in terms of the private capital world, especially as we see rates going up, that, you know, there doesn't feel like there's as much transparency and that could be problematic.
Interesting.
Maybe not systemic, but.
Well, okay, great. I mean, absolutely. The scale of capital is remarkable. And this is sort of.
Private capital.
Private capital, exactly. For example, last year alone, $1.3 trillion.
Right.
You know, it's 1.2, 1.3. But critically, that's just what's raised by fund managers. You've got to throw in there all the Canadian pension plans. By the way, CPB is also on our board of directors, as is Future Fund from Australia. It's trillions and trillions of dollars of liquidity. It's just so that the scale of money that is available, you've got all the Chinese billionaires, you've got family offices, you know, there's so much
everybody
money.
Wants in right now. Because the thing is, okay, there's also
more nervous.
So much talk of the opportunity in private credit. It's become kind of the darling of investors really from retail up now.
Right. Well, I was speaking across all private capital strategies in private equity, venture capital, infrastructure, real assets. So there's a lot in there.
What's really hot right now?
So the two, you're mentioning private credit, which absolutely is a huge driver. So if I had to say a strategy that's growing really quickly, I'd say private credit. And there was $14 billion in private credit fundraising last year. KKR had a big Asia private credit fund. Apollo had a big private credit fund. Big manager in India is raising $1.6 billion for their private credit fund just focused on India. Then the other, I would highlight two other big drivers, particularly in our markets. Climate and anything sustainability focused, huge driver.
Seriously.
Absolutely.
Different from the ESG phenomenon.
Absolutely. But absolutely. Huge driver. And I would make this critical distinction. ESG, it's kind of like the working with terminology like emerging markets. It can mean anything, right? What is ESG? What is impact? I mean, the definitions really are, there's a lot of
regulation.
Which
is why it's kind of going through a reckoning.
You make them up yourself, basically. Those definitions.
It feels that way.
Particularly, it's funny when you say, you know, transparency. I believe that there's actually a greater opportunity for transparency in private capital strategies, because you can see what's in portfolios. You can look at the portfolio company level,
Not every portfolio.
Well, in the I guess I would say in the markets that we represent.
Okay.
Going in.
I mean, if you're a pension fund, you can look at it, right?
Yeah. I mean.
Or. Go ahead.
I'm speaking specifically to the markets that we're in.
Okay.
And in the markets that we're in, you know, governance and transparency and, you know, going in and cleaning up that type of stuff from the outset. And there's so much leverage. So I don't know, when you're thinking from a risk perspective, you're thinking about the amount of leverage that's been put on.
Like if KKR or Apollo has a fund, I don't necessarily know everything that's in it.
You know, here's another driver I would point
right,
out.
Right, though?
Yeah. I honestly can't answer that question.
Yeah, no, I think Carol...
But they put it out in their annual report.
Carol and I both have been grappling with trying to value the entire size of the private credit market, for example. And that data is difficult for us to get.
Private credit is going to be much less transparent than private equity.
Correct. Yeah. Yes.
Because in private equity, you're talking about typically investments in... So, but private credit is... absolutely less transparent.
But private equity, if you're getting into private firms, I guess there's announcements. There has to be, like, to some extent.
Yeah, the deal portfolio is on the website.
Right.
And I would make another point, which is one of the things that I find really exciting about what I do and the opportunity, the way the industry is changing. Just in the space of the last 5 years, the level of accountability and the shift in thinking in private capital globally is remarkable. You look at, you know, the examples of founders being pushed out because of even a hint of impropriety. There is so much more focus on long-term reputation because, let's face it, you know, one bad step reputationally is, you know, has a major impact. And
look at Crispin O'Day.
Exactly. Yeah. And then,
but I do wonder about private equity concentration in fields, and we've talked about it with healthcare or, you know, in vet service. I mean, there's a lot of concentration.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, not in the markets that I focus on. So this is our platform, which is basically that there is such a scale of capital available to be invested. The leverage ratios, there's virtually no leverage in the markets we represent. Each is a huge, again, you know, there's very little leverage. And you're investing in, rather than sort of trading portfolio company to manager to manager, you're investing in things from the bottom up.
Come back soon. Kate Ambrose, CEO at the Global Private Capital Association, here in studio, right here on Bloomberg.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Hey, earlier this year, Jeff Green, we caught up with, and he's been reporting how women gained 34 seats on the boards of S&P 500 companies. In the first 2 months of the year, it was the strongest start since at least 2019, bolstered by the naming of three female chief executive officers. Matt, I will say I will be so happy when we stop counting women on boards, CEOs, and all that good stuff.
Well, I'll be happy when the market punishes you for not having the diversity that you need, right? Because the idea is that if you increase diversity on your board in your company, then you will grow your revenues and also make, you know, more money and profits.
Diversity means financial
so
benefits.
At some point, you know, assuming that that's true, good companies will have diverse boards, and those that don't have diverse boards won't do as well. That's right. The idea, right?
So let's see what our next guest has to say. She's got a front row seat to all of this. Heather Spilsbury is Chief Operating Officer at 50/50 Women on Boards. It's a nonprofit committed to, quote, integrating diversity and inclusion into the fabric of corporate governance. I've got that from their website. She's with us on Zoom from LA. Sorry about the frivolity. It's just one of those days. Heather, good to have you here. It's not frivolous when we talk about the importance of diversity on boards or at companies. Tell us a little bit about your organization and whether or not we're making progress here.
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me and for having 50/50 Women on Boards. It's great to be here with you today and appreciate that introduction. That was fantastic. So we're a nonprofit organization that, like you said, helps elevate women in the pipeline to corporate board service. And we do this through educational programs for corporations to ensure that they understand the importance of having a diverse board and what it means for them from a profitability standpoint, productivity, and also workforce engagement. And then we also invite companies to then bring their women employees and clients into the fold in our in-person strategic networking events that are held throughout the year across the globe in the United States, Mexico, Canada, Europe, Athens, Greece, and Tokyo, Japan. So that's our way of making sure that people understand what it means to have a diverse board and why it's so important. And to your point earlier, I heard you talking, but it is sad that we're still talking about gender. But until we get there, I think we have to reinforce why it's so important to have.
But as Matt says, if we McKinsey's been doing research for years.
Right.
I mean, I think I have a child as old as.
Do you know what
McKinsey's
I'll say?
Been doing research.
I'll go
and she's
back.
20.
Carol and I have been working together for 20 years.
Yes.
And about 20 years ago, Mindy Grossman, I think, told us both mm-hmm. this story about when she was on the board at Nike and they were like, we need to sell more shoes to women. And she looked around the room and she was the only female there. And she's like, well, maybe right. if you get more of me, you could sell more shoes to these women. So that reinforced my idea. That made me into a kind of gender diversity evangelist. I've been saying since then, if you want to sell more shoes to women, put more women on your board.
Right.
Is that proving to be true? Is it proving to work?
Yeah, it is. And it's important to note that we start with women because women are still lacking on corporate boards and women of color, of course. So once we can get there, then we can talk about other underrepresented groups where we're not even there yet. So I think our point is really to elevate women in the pipeline because women tend to bring diversity as well with them. So they'll bring diverse candidates into the fold from a leadership standpoint and also a board service standpoint. So I think that's the goal. And what she was trying to say was it can't just be her in the room and she's right. We know from our research, and we look at the Russell 3000 companies, but there's still 60 companies that have zero women, and there's still 364 that only have one woman. And that's not a cohort. That's not enough to have
but
a voice.
But why, Heather? Why? And going back to the point of the
good
research
question.
Has been there for such a long time about the importance of diversity
yeah.
and what it can mean financially. I mean, I've always feel like yeah. follow the money. Everybody follows the money. So why aren't we following the money if it really has a financial impact?
The thing we hear time and time again is that companies cannot find diverse candidates or can't find women candidates that fit the exact
is that true?
Expertise or it's not true. But here's what happens. And it's like anything. I equate it to looking for a new employee or even when you're looking for a restaurant, right? When you're so hungry, you can't find anything or you don't know where to go because it's an automatic need and a position to fill. But what you need to do is to develop your board and your board governance to say, hey, we need to develop succession planning and programming that when so-and-so is timed out or his time serving on the board or her time serving on the board is done, we have someone else in the pipeline we're going to elevate based on the expertise and skills we're looking for. And so that way it makes finding a candidate that much easier. It's also one of the reasons we launched 50 Women to Watch for boards this year was because we were tired of hearing that excuse of we can't find qualified candidates or women of color who fit this exact mold. And it's like they're they exist. There is a list that we've launched yesterday where you can search by primary expertise, industry, race and ethnicity. It's all there for you to search to be able to find these vetted candidates that we're hoping that these corporations that still are lacking women can tap into and use it as opposed to saying we can't find the right candidates.
So are you talking to corporations and showing them? I mean, obviously we're talking about your list
yeah.
here, but have you emailed the heads of HR
right.
at every Fortune 500
yeah.
company?
Here's the list.
Yeah. We're doing that outreach. It's tough to reach out to every CHRO. So sometimes you have to do it through public listings, including their investment relations team, and send them notes to ensure that they're aware that we're asking them to add more women to their boards. It's an effort. It takes not only our organization, but other organizations who are on a mission to do the same thing, to say, hey, here's a list you can tap into, or here's my members that you can tap into. And collectively, we've all decided that this is the mission that we're after, and this is how we're gonna go and approach companies and encourage them to add women. And why it's so important for their business. But again, to your point, it's an educational process. And then part of that process is saying, here's vetted candidates you can tap into. So yes, that's part of the goal.
Hey, real quickly, 30 seconds here. Are female CEOs or maybe minority CEOs more likely to put women on their board? Just very quickly.
They are, and we have research to back that up in our When Women Lead research, but it is true that when a woman is a CEO, the board is more diverse and the workplace culture is more diverse, and they're more apt to bringing more women up with them in the fold and diverse candidates and underrepresented groups.
Well, really cool to check in with you. So appreciate it. Heather Spilsbury, she's Chief Operating Officer at 50/50 Women on Boards, joining us on Zoom from Los Angeles. As we said, it's a nonprofit, and they are all about diversity and inclusion when it comes to corporate governance. I mean, on boards, you can measure it. You know exactly who's on a corporate board if you're a publicly held entity, or even most entities, right? You can check out the board and get an idea if it's diverse.
Absolutely.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
Yeah, a little bit of a...
Can we play this?
What do you mean?
I feel like... Don't we have to pay somebody if we play this? I don't know why it's specifically the Beatles, but I feel like it's expensive to play the Beatles.
I think you're allowed to play a certain amount.
Like less than 30 seconds.
But you know what's really important? We're going to talk about a revolution that's going on.
Yeah. I've been on Reddit lately. I know what's going on.
So let's get to it, because this story, it has to do with really kind of a changing world, whether it's the ad market online, whether it's AI. There's a lot of stuff that we're trying to figure out in a very new environment for the social media world. Our Joshua Brustein gets into it in the new upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. So let's get to it. Joshua, of course, here with us, along with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, Joel Weber. Joshua, by the way, is Bloomberg Business Week technology editor. So the story is very telling, right? As we talk so much about AI, Joel, and trying to understand the importance of data going forward. It's important to AI. Generative AI.
Yeah, and then there's Reddit, which is just, I think, you know, for the past couple of years, become the great hope of the internet. It is, you know, as we've seen...
So weird.
So weird.
But I remember it was no one's hope.
The genius of Reddit, though, was that it reminded us of how great the internet was, like, in 2002, before there were social networks and stuff. And it just was, it's so basic, you know, and it just puts it all out there.
Yeah.
And I learned everything I know about crypto originally on Reddit. Like before it was $1,000 Bitcoin, I went on Reddit. I joined the subreddit. I got to know people. I bought my first Bitcoin through the subreddit, you know, for $600.
Yeah. What's your handle? Like Leather Jacket?
I can't tell you.
No, inside joke there from yesterday. What struck me about this, though,
on
was
our podcast
that
feed,
also, if you were going to swallow the internet, Reddit would be a pretty great place to start. And that's sort of what's kicked off this current controversy. And reminder, Reddit, still not a publicly traded company, which has also been part of this. So Josh, what happened?
Well, what happened started in April when Reddit said it was going to start charging for API usage. This is basically how you would systemically ingest Reddit data for your own programs. And as you mentioned, one big use of the Reddit API is to take data and use it to train AI models. It's part of the model that is used to train ChatGPT. I think Google's model uses it as well. And it's just this big data set of people talking. And if you want to teach a computer to talk like a person, Reddit's one place to start. So Reddit wanted to make
sure. AI smart, Matt.
I get it. You're training with Reddit. I mean, actually, my wife works for a company, I won't name it, that scrapes places like Twitter and Reddit for data. They do that for corporations so that, for example, this is not a client, I'm just using it. If Pepsi wants to know, you know, how people on Twitter feel about them, this company goes and uses the Twitter API and scrapes all the mentions and figures out, you know, which are positive, which are negative, and which are neutral. So,
yeah.
Yeah, and that's
learning,
actually
we're learning a lot about Matt, you know. Right. And I'm glad that the revolution was hinted at the beginning because, yeah, you know.
And what Reddit wants to do is make your wife's company pay for that.
Yes,
because they are
exactly
getting some commercial use from this. And at first, the announcement was made in April. You know, people said, "Huh, that's an interesting look at like what might happen with AI in the future." And then it became clear that this was also going to impact a lot of developers that make apps on Reddit that Reddit users really like today. And Reddit users really didn't like that. And after some negotiations, if you can call it that, with the company refused to change its policies. And the entire site, or big parts of the site, went dark last week.
So, I mean, for example, Carol uses Twitter, not through Twitter.com, but she has some third-party
TweetDeck
that she uses. And TweetDeck, I guess, would hook up to Twitter with an API as well. And you're talking about people using Reddit with such third-party apps, right?
Yeah, exactly. There are some very popular Reddit readers that ingest Reddit and give you a better or give you a different user interface. Those apps run ads that they don't share the revenue with Reddit, so Reddit wants some of that revenue. But also the API is used to build tools that things like the volunteer moderators that make Reddit run use just in their day-to-day use. And that was really kind of what moderators said. If you take this away from us, we can't do our jobs and we're giving you free labor. So
yeah, which is key part there. Josh writes, but Reddit power users are something else, using the site in a way that seems more like employment than leisure, except for the getting paid part. Like, this is one of the amazing things about the internet. You find a community of people who care, and they will do all that work for free.
Yeah.
Right? Which also is, I'm sure, part of what, you know, the AI swallowing it all likes.
Yeah. At the heart of it, this is a conflict between two groups of people who said, I don't want to do something without getting paid for it, or getting, you know, I don't want to do something for free if you're going to exploit me. The moderators being exploited by
if
Reddit.
Somebody else is going to get paid, and I'm
Reddit
not, right?
Being exploited by the AI companies or the third-party app companies or whoever.
I love there's a quote in, it's a professor at the Institute for Advanced Study, and I guess it was in the Biden administration's Office for Technology and Science Policy. People are anticipating that there's a change in the economy of the internet company, right? We're finding the ad model can just go so far, right? And now we're increasingly, we knew data was worth something, right? We've all been trying to figure out who ultimately benefits from all that data collection, right? And now we're kind of getting to a whole new level of it because it's needed to make generative AI so much smarter, right? And that's kind of what it gets into on a bigger, broader level.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people are very nervous about the changes coming in the internet. And there's a question about who creates value online and who is going to be compensated for that value and how.
Okay, so what does this mean for that IPO that never quite happened?
Well, I think it's fair to say, although Reddit will not say, that part of the initial reason to do the changes were to shore up its business as it looks ahead to this IPO. And I think how it impacts it really depends on the outcome of this. There's real concern out there that if the moderators continue to be in revolt, that Reddit won't work as well and might not be as good of a business going forward and might kind of fail to function as a service.
What it reminds me of a little bit is the Dungeons and Dragons cover story that we did not so long ago, because Hasbro also tweaked the licensing agreement before the big blockbuster came out, right? And the nerds did not like that. There was a revolt online. Then Hasbro ultimately had to back down, but there was so much money at stake. And here we are again.
It's very similar.
I won't call Reddit users nerds, but
they are nerds.
Okay, yeah. Well, you said it. Yeah. But it basically creates this moment where you've got, you know, a platform that everyone has turned to. I mean, this is the hope of what it was, a Back to the Future bet that the future of the internet actually maybe looked more like Reddit. And all of a sudden, the underlying value proposition is the thing that is at risk.
It is pretty crazy.
Mic drop. Do we?
Oh, no, you're 100% right.
No, it's really kind of, right? It's kind of heavy thinking of like how this moves forward.
Well, here's the thing. AI is the dawn of generative AI has made us all realize, oh, Reddit is worth something.
I mean,
there's real value there.
It's also highly entertaining, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I've loved Reddit for over a decade.
You still use it?
I use it all the time, like literally every day on multiple devices. But I always thought it was...
Power user.
I always thought it was fairly worthless. Although, I guess now that I think about it,
it's not,
it answers for me so many questions.
What? Your time, your eyeballs, think about how much that's worth. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. So they should pay me.
What is Reddit thinking, Joshua, inside, internally, as they work this through?
Well, Reddit has said there have been some memos that have come out from inside the company where the executives say, you know, these flaps happen every once in a while. Reddit is a very restive community. And the idea is
that
like,
is
let's
totally
keep our,
true.
Let's keep our heads down. You know, we'll take our lumps and a month from now, everything will be back to normal and we can, you know, move forward with this plan. The economics will be better and problem solved, or at least, you know, problem lessened.
Who are the evil overlords that run Reddit? Like Alexis Ohanian is gone, right? Now he's like gone. A women's soccer guy. So who are the bosses? Yeah, who's the corporate face of Reddit?
So the CEO of Reddit is Steve Huffman, the other co-founder. And Reddit, as you might remember, was bought by Condé Nast soon after it was founded. And it is now an independent subsidiary, or it is its majority owner remains Advanced Publications, which is Condé's parent company.
Cool.
So how do we think they might attempt to navigate this, Josh? Like, what are their options, really? And you're right. They have gone through this before. I'm thinking of, remember the anti-work kerfuffle where like the community sort of ousted the moderator that it had, right? And like, there's been tensions like this that have simmered before. But how do you think they go about navigating this?
Yeah, this kind of thing happens from time to time, and I think that's what Reddit is betting on. And Reddit says it's going to build a lot of moderator tools, or has already released some that will replace some of these third-party tools that might not be able to function if they have to pay for the APIs. And I think that they'll hope that moderators will find out that, oh, these things work okay. Maybe this isn't such a big deal after all. I love Reddit, and it turns out I can continue to do my job. And, you know, and they got mad, and then they get better, and things calm down for a little while until the next time they get mad.
And what about for the AI companies that are out there attempting to swallow the internet? Like, will they pay up? What do you think that dialogue looks like?
It certainly seems like the AI companies are preparing to pay in some way. You know, Reddit is not the number one source of material, but there may be some licensing deals worked out, and I think the economics that are on
the table. Well, you've just provided me with another question. I mean, what is the number one source of material, if not Reddit?
Well, you know, it makes you wonder, like, where do these lies come from? Well, I wonder where they're getting their information.
Where should I be going?
Is Wikipedia a better source? I mean, what are these AI models gobbling up?
All of it.
Yeah.
All of it. No hierarchy. Just
it's an immense, it's a large range. I actually don't know off the top of my head what the number one source is, but there's like thousands of websites that it's scraping and, you know, putting together.
I'm sure millions even.
What does this mean for Elon and Twitter potentially? He's trying to figure it out too, right?
Well, one thing that this shows is that you know, Reddit users have some power over the site, whereas Twitter users don't really. I mean, people are mad at Elon, and Elon's like, well, go ahead. You can leave if you want, but they can't shut Twitter down.
And they don't leave, by the way. if you look at the data, actually usage has increased.
Everybody lost their checks and we're like, okay.
Everybody said, like, when Trump got elected, people were like, I'm going to move out of this country if Trump gets elected.
Fast forward,
nobody moved out. Yeah. Same thing about with Twitter. You know, they said, I'm going to quit Twitter if Elon Musk takes over. They're all still there.
Yeah. I'm genuinely curious here. When you go to Reddit, like, what are the sub-threads that you traffic in?
I feel like that's such a private question, which is why I won't even tell you my handle. Like, the last thing in the world I want is for anybody to see my Reddit.
Was it money bags? Now, I've worked with Matt for so long, and he said something earlier, and I'm like, you still surprise me. 20-plus years in coming.
He's full of surprises.
Yes. You don't maintain multiple Twitter or Reddit handles?
I do have many.
One for each device.
So tell us your family-friendly Reddit handle.
Come on, there's got to be like, you know...
I mean, so Grateful I Dead look Dad. At so I look in I look at like a leather jackets thing. Although for that I use even more embarrassing forums than Reddit. Like
we learned yesterday, Matt is very.
I'm kind of obsessed with leather jackets. I'm also kind of obsessed with leather boots and shoes. And Reddit has a very good forum for boots.
So we actually didn't ask you about this yesterday. NVIDIA's CEO Jensen owns the leather jacket.
Yeah.
Where do you rank his leather jacket? Like critique?
Yeah, I don't
he's
know.
He's got more than one though.
Exactly. Multiple. So I don't, they didn't look so amazing. I don't think he's getting them from like the best shinky horsehide tanneries in Japan.
You should reach out. I think that
is
would
he
be.
Is he on the Reddit forum?
He could do a great story.
Well,
right?
The thing is, for jackets, you've got to go to the Fedora Lounge, which is even worse.
Please,
right?
We're going to connect you. I think there needs to be, fashion consulting with Matt.
I'll reach out to NVIDIA.
How come somebody put chaps in our IB chat? Did you say chaps?
Chaps? Now chaps?
Yeah, I don't know.
Leather pants is what he's asking about. I have a few pairs of chaps, you know.
But that's for riding your motorcycle.
And we're good.
Or used to, yeah. All right, maybe not. Okay, talk about a revolution. We just had one. All right, that's a wrap. Guys, thank you so much.
Great,
Joshua Brustein, tech editor at Bloomberg Business Week, here in studio along with Jill Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. The story in the new issue of Business Week magazine on newsstands tomorrow, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek and on the Bloomberg. And on Leather Chaps, we're taking a break. This is Bloomberg.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's get to it, folks. Just about 18 minutes left in today's trading session. Bouncing around on the equity side, another leg down off our highs of the session. Down the most on the NASDAQ, as you just heard from Charlie and Bill. In the meantime, we've seen rates also bouncing around following that first day of testimony from Fed Chair Jay Powell up on Capitol Hill. We get more testimony tomorrow, Matt, but it's usually kind of like the same old movie.
Yeah, it's always interesting to me, you know, because I guess
I love it.
The questions that they ask sometimes, and I'm sure they are the most educated and well-informed people in the country, but sometimes make me lose faith in our leaders just for a brief moment.
Somebody I used to work with who would be like, really? Now, I do feel like it's very political and very grandstanding, right? Like,
of course
hey, look
it
what
is.
I'm doing for you folks.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
The interesting thing this time is that you have so many people out there who don't believe that the Fed is going to raise rates again, who think that this cycle is over, even though the dot plot showed us two more increases and Powell said at the last meeting that they were going to raise rates again. Now he comes back and says once again that they are going to raise rates. So... yeah, I don't know.
It's like, folks, let me draw you a picture.
Yeah.
Let's see what the market picture is according to our next guest. Our Drive to the Close guest on this Wednesday is Phil Taves. He's CEO, portfolio manager also at Taves Asset Management, also the founder of Behavioral Investing Institute, which is an organization, devoted to helping advisors manage investor behavior through market challenges, which is, I would say, a really timely thing and useful thing right now. He's on Zoom in New York City. Phil, nice to have you here with Matt and myself on Business Week. This market environment, a lot of momentum to the upside despite the huge short position that's out there when it comes to the S&P 500. What would you bet? More to the upside, more to the downside? How do you see it?
Well, I don't want to ruin, by the way, it's a pleasure to be with you again, always. I don't want to ruin my reputation as a doom and gloomer, but you know, I guess I don't want to spoil that. But the reality is that sometimes you just have to embrace the boom. And I think at the moment, you know, right, the last couple of days we've seen a move down, but we had such a huge rally before that. And there's just so much money on the sidelines. I feel like I'd almost bet on momentum at this moment.
You know, sometimes I embrace a second or third glass of wine. It's not always the best thing for me. So I'm just curious, like, if you embrace it, are you just riding the momentum? It doesn't mean that fundamentally that supports that momentum.
No, I think fundamentally it doesn't support it. There's a great word that John Kenneth Galbraith came up with, which is bezel, from the word embezzlement. Mm-hmm. And the way Charlie Munger uses it is the difference between the price we're paying for assets and fundamental value. So if you ask that question that way, then no, we don't deserve to continue to rally because we're, you know, above where we should be. The huge thing that I think, if historical precedent matters, and I guess to some, like maybe courts, it doesn't, but if historical precedent matters, interest rate trends are really long-term things. So, you know, 25 years, the latter half of the 19th century, and then it's like 20-year chunk, you know, between 1945 and 1981, rates were moving higher, and, you know, then down for 40 years. And so why do we think that rates are just going to move up for 18 months and then it's going to end? And also the history of inflation is different. The history of inflation is that inflation goes up between 4 and 9 years, not 18 months. So I think that longer term, we're going to be probably higher for longer than we would want to be with rates. I think longer term, that is a negative for potential for stocks, at least based on current valuation. So, but ride the momentum. Let's go with it. There's so much cash on the sidelines.
Yep. You're not alone, by the way.
I'll stop talking for a second.
Well, you're not alone. I noticed today that KKR chief macro strategist Henry McVeigh said investors are poorly positioned for growth, maybe unexpected growth that's going to be stronger than the market thinks this year. And McVeigh also said inflation may be tamer than the markets expect this year, only a little bit. But he said that KKR is going to embrace more risk, at least right now in the short term. They are looking at more opportunities. But I feel like there's a limit, right, to the amount of risk that you want to embrace. And our producer, when he was preparing us for today's show, said that you like Kathy Wood's ARK. And I thought, that's just nuts. Are you advising people? Because that seems like, you know, putting it all on Black 21.
There's a lot of investors who don't think it's nuts because they've been pouring money into it.
Okay, so I did not say that. So anyway, what I said is that the graph for NVIDIA looks a lot like the graph in ARK ETF did back at the end of 2021 when it was just parabolic up. And then we know what happened, parabolic down after that. So that tends to be what's supporting the market right now. We've got just a handful of stocks up hugely, and that's what we all know, that's all the gains of the S&P 500. So it wouldn't take much to tip us lower. But you know, we actually come with a fully baked solution. I think what's important for investors is that they maintain their full equity allocation right now, but do it in a way that makes sense and addresses contingency. Take half of it and put it in hedged equity funds, stuff that has options underneath it that can appreciate if the market moves lower. So that way you're there with stock over the long haul during periods of inflation. Historically, stocks have done reasonably well. At least they've kept up with inflation much better than bonds have. So I think get your bond allocation or get your stock allocation done if you've been avoiding doing it because Mike Wilson persuaded you not to. Just get your allocation done, but do with hedged equity funds.
Wow, and smackdowns. You're doing a lot of smackdowns here. Wow, you better lock your door there, buddy. Well, it's interesting. So then where would you put money to work in this market environment?
You just buy the Qs. The Qs have outperformed every active asset manager for the last 15 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be nice to have some there. One of our funds, THLGX, has a 70% allocation to S&P and 30% allocation to triple Qs, but it all has options underneath it. And we can trend follow out of that into cash positions if you need to be. So I think it's great to have growth right now. You know, if you're just on small and mid has disappointed on a relative basis, although part of that could be returned to the mean after, you know, after what we saw about a month ago. Part of that small cap deterioration was a result of regional banks. So if we can see a recovery there, you know, I think it's probably being allocated across a diversified equity portfolio isn't a terrible idea right now.
I'm just looking at THLGX and I see, I wonder what you can tell us about the top holdings. Where do you have in THLGX?
I just got about 30 seconds.
It's just a hedged index strategy. So we own S&P 500 index positions through futures contracts. And the same thing with triple Qs. We just own the futures contracts in there. But the way that works is if markets start to roll over and they move below a target exit level, we move to the sidelines so we can be in treasury bills if that happens. We spent most of 2022 in T-bills in that fund. The other thing we have, though, options protection is so cheap right now. Yep. We have a layer about 12% below that market for full notional.
So
and it costs almost nothing.
So ride it up and then just be ready to bail and find another way out, it sounds like. Phil, really fun. Phil Taves, CEO at Taves Asset Management, on Zoom from New York City. He's looking over his shoulder now.
Is Mike Wilson coming?
Exactly. This is Bloomberg.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. On Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 G's in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.